Welcome to The Way We Look, where we talk about how society shapes how we view others and ourselves. We are your hosts. I'm Shakir Rimzi.
I'm Aiden Lee.
I'm Tiffany Mongu.
And I'm Aaliyah Harris.
Today we have four stories, each produced by the four of us here. While the stories at first glance don't appear to be connected, by changing the way we look at things, we can find out that they all revolve around themes of community, identity, and belonging. Questions about how do we belong and how do we make sense of that belonging are pertinent, and it doesn't matter if it's within the lens of the individual, community, or even a country. We begin today with a look at the individual. Here is, introducing his first feature, Aiden Lee.
Hi there. So I think we're just going to start off our first feature, and I did a lot of work with social media and beauty people in the industry, and I feel like a lot of the work that we do is so much on how we look. And over the years, plastic surgery has really been on the rise, especially with teens and young people, because of the strive for perfection. I just kind of want to start off by saying, like, rhinoplasty is one of the most popular procedures to get done and can cost anywhere between like $7,000 to $8,000 in Canada. That is like a year of school for some people. Or something like lip injections can cost up to $500 to $800 depending on where you go. But what do these procedures really give people? I sat down with two girls who talked about their lives before and after their surgery.
Hi, my name is Sohina Dillon. I am 20 years old and I am a third year kinesiology student at York University. I also work for a company called 360 Kids. They have an after school program and I am the program assistant for this company.
Hi, my name is Hannah Wing and I'm 22 years old. I go to Brock University. I'm a full-time student. I also work part-time at Michael Kors.
So basically, growing up, I was an athlete and I played a lot of sports, including basketball, soccer, tennis, volleyball, and hockey. Until beginning of high school, I started playing sports more intensely and I got hit in the face multiple times. And over the years, I developed a bump on my nose, which I did not like at all. I thought it was very prominent.
Yes. I used to be really insecure about nose, like I hated it, but then over time I grew to really accept it. I just noticed growing up, especially in the super like white area, like Caucasian population, everyone would always, like they have similar, you know how the Asian nose is typical because it's different, it's flat, there's no bridge. So like I always noticed, I'm like, wow, my lips are, I mean, my nose is different from theirs. Like, and then in the media, you see like the perfect nose, all this stuff. If I had the option and the money to do, then I would.
For about 5 years, I tried convincing my parents to let me get a nose job. Being Indian and being brown, it is very hard to tell family members this because they don't see it as important or natural when we get these kind of procedures. You know, I'll pay for it myself, even though they did help me out a little bit, but it did take a while for them to realize that, you know what, like this, I guess Sahina's nose does bother her a lot, and if it makes her feel better about herself by getting it done, then we're gonna, you know, go ahead with the procedure. They basically put me under an anesthetic. I was out for about an hour. The whole surgery took about an hour. And when I woke up, I was in a lot of pain. My nose was in a lot of pain. I felt like somebody punched me in the nose with a brick. I had a lot of help from my parents, especially my mom. I did not go to school for a week. She did not go to work for a week. She stayed home with me. It was very difficult for me to walk around. So the second cosmetic procedure that I got was lip augmentation, and that was in November of the same year. And I went to the same doctor and I explained to them that, you know what, like my lips are not that thin, but I feel like with my new nose, getting lip fillers would look a lot better, especially after seeing all my friends get it.
Yes, because that's why I started overdrawing. I would say almost 2 years ago, I decided to start getting lip fillers. And I think over the 2 years, I accumulated over, I would say almost 4.5 millimeters of lip filler, like syringes. So wait, I think that would be 4 millimeters of syringes or of lip filler of two different brands, and I've tried two different injectors over the 2 years, because there was a time where I literally got out of control and I like they were so big, because like it's just addicting to do, because I think what people like is change, like they love to see change, you know what I mean? Like when people go to the gym, they want to see change immediately. So it's just like when you first did it, you're like, wow, like you're obsessed, and then you do it again and again and again, and it got too big. So I never really actually wanted to get my lips done at all. But then I guess when I got older, the trend shifted a lot, especially with Kylie Jenner's era of getting lip fillers. Like everyone started getting it. And then that was like the societal norm, like nice, like big juicy lips. And then that was the trigger to make me go. I think at the time growing up, you're so influenced by everything around you. You want to strive to be perfect and all this other stuff.
I feel that once I have gotten these procedures done, I feel a lot better about my physical features, that I don't need to cover it all up with makeup. I don't mind showing my side profile anymore. I don't need to overline my lips or use any lip plumping tools, which is two of the biggest reasons why I did get these procedures done, and I feel a lot better about myself. These cosmetic procedures are not meant to change your face. I feel that if you get them done properly and by the right doctor, they can definitely enhance your beauty or enhance whatever you don't like about your face, not completely change them, which I think is so important when getting anything done.
That's true. When people are like, it's for happiness, it's actually not for happiness. It's to enhance and add to your happiness, but it's not going to solve, like, I don't think it's going to make you, it's going to change your life and make you a happy person, but it will enhance your happiness. Plastic surgery is good, but it's not a miracle worker. If it's something that makes you happy, do it. If it's something that you want to fix, do it. But just know that at the end of the day, it's not going to fix your happiness though.
So I think we should just start off the conversation, because I feel like we're all within that kind of age range where we're so impacted by what is around us and social media, because, I mean, our generation uses so much of it. So I just kind of want to throw out a question about, what do you guys think about, I guess, like young people trying to strive for this idea of perfection and what it really means for us.
So I found it really interesting that she mentioned Kylie Jenner by name. Like that was a model to aspire to. That was somebody that you had to emulate. And you're getting these procedures done to the tune of thousands of dollars because you want to look like somebody you've never met, or look at somebody that has this large social media presence. Now, as somebody who doesn't follow a lot of social, like I don't even have a public Instagram. I find it a little strange, but that's my perspective. But you're willing to augment your body in order to emulate somebody else. So it's interesting for me, and I'm not a huge fan.
Yeah, I feel like I was thinking that when I was kind of listening to the whole Kylie Jenner idea, how this is coming from someone who's young, but like a young adult. So how it kind of goes into, how do younger people feel about this kind of thing when they see people like this in social media? What are their opinions on their own bodies when they're still growing and maybe they don't have all that knowledge like we do, and how it affects those kind of people too? So that was interesting to hear her opinions.
Also, just to add on that, I think it's kind of like, I feel like social media doesn't really speak on how bad these things could be, like how bad plastic surgery could be, and I feel like the only con that's brought up is normally just like the pricing of it, like the ranges of money that you're expected to spend on, I don't know, like fixing your nose or like fixing your lips or something. But it doesn't really talk about like the after side effects that a person could experience if they enhance their lips a certain way, or if they enhance their noses or their eyes and stuff. Actually, like, I remember there was T.I.'s wife and daughter, and they got, like, slandered by social media because of the way they wanted to, like, I mean, sorry, of the way they upgraded their eye color through surgery. And they were just being attacked on the fact that, like, you know, you're causing so much damage to your health and stuff like that. And later on, even during that time, like, it came onto the news that they were, like, the daughter was actually facing problems and issues. And I feel like the same should go for whenever someone is trying to do, like, plastic surgery and stuff.
But that Aiden, you should
talk about, like, their the damages it could cause.
Aiden, but your piece, the vibe I got from it, you're fairly pro plastic surgery. You're highlighting a lot of the benefits of it, because the girls had very specific reasons for doing these procedures. One with the nose damage from sports. Mm-hmm. So just can you clarify your position on that?
I think, first of all, I have no particular opinion when it comes to plastic surgery. I say do it if you want to, do it if you don't. I mean, don't do it if you don't want to. I think at the end of the day, because I work within, like, that area and I'm so immersed within that culture, I get it. Like, people post different photos and they curate, like, this perfect image. Like, I do it too. Like, I'm guilty of it. I fix things. I clear things up and I alter the image. And I feel like with media education, it's like everyone knows that everything is kind of fake online, but I feel like a part of us wants to believe that it's so real and we want to really buy into that fantasy. So I think I want to kind of end up on, because I feel like this conversation was kind of saying that plastic surgery is a bad thing. I don't think plastic surgery is a bad thing. I just say that if it makes someone a little bit more confident and makes them feel like they can take on the world a little bit more, I say go for it. And I think, like, that is just kind of the purpose of my story. I kind of just wanted to shed that light.
All right. Thank you, Aiden, for that feature. Our second feature moves from the realm of the individual to issues within the fashion industry. Joining me is Aaliyah Harris with her feature, Colorism in the Fashion Industry.
We live in a society where image is important. When you don't fulfill the image of what mainstream beauty looks like and you're not represented as much as other people around you, it becomes this normality to want to aspire to be something other than yourself. So altering your physical appearance can be easily done, but what about when you're programmed to feel uncomfortable within your own skin? Every day these situations occur, and I wanted to look deeper into an industry that focuses highly on people's appearance. Diving into the world of fashion, I took to the streets to investigate shadism, also known as colorism, among women.
I couldn't find clothing in my nude shade. I just thought it would be a great look. It wasn't anything too deep, and when I started Googling, I couldn't find anything. And then the second part of that, which is a bit deeper, is I started thinking about, well, why isn't there anything in a nude shade for my color? And how come when I Google nude, everything is beige?
You've heard of racism and sexism. But what about shadism? For the women involved in the world of fashion, it is a real problem. Communities are banding together to educate and change the public. I met with Nicole Lucas Richardson, founder of Good Form.
So shadism has been recognized as an interracial discriminatory practice, but it's also outside of that. And we've seen that a lot in marketing. So we would see a lot of more quote-unquote multicultural brand campaigns, but the women of color were either Latin or light-skinned black woman and lighter eyes, hazel or a very light brown eye with a tint of blonde in the hair. Or you were seeing the very heavily pigmented black woman that was thinner, that was somewhat a glamorized version of the stereotypes of what an African woman would look like. It's not necessarily saying that one particular group of people are superior to the next. It's more like within that group of people, these are our ideals of beauty. I've recently started a company called Good Form, a digital platform that brings apparel, makeup, accessories, and nude shades for people of all colors. We want to start building a community. We like being part of the conversation around shadism, colorism, and that thought process, but also because we want feedback from our market. And I really wanted a company to start something that put people who have always been secondary or tertiary consumers at the forefront.
Danica Hooper spoke to me about her experiences of shadism right before judging at a casting event.
I'm in FSN 706, which is the fashion event planning course at Ryerson, and I'm the styling and collections lead. I'm working with a bridal wear brand called Lover's Land, showcasing their newest bridal wear collection. Our client wants diversity, so we're looking for models of all ethnicities, all genders, as long as they're comfortable in gowns and lingerie. We want to stray away from the whole tall, blonde, white girl, because right now, no shade, but like, they don't have that much diversity in theirs, so introducing that to them will be like a huge deal for their brand. I'm from the Philippines. In the Philippines, even though there were a lot of morenos, which is brown girls, there was still a stigma of being lighter is better because we were westernized and like colonized for a long time. And so that kind of just stayed within that culture. Even though I was living in the Philippines basically my entire life, I still didn't feel represented. When big fashion houses are starting to hire more people of color, it obviously makes me feel good about myself.
I am Black. I identify as Black, African Canadian. I've experienced both sides of shadism. I'm one of the darker ones on my mom's side of the family, so I get the don't play in the sun too long or make sure you're right, wear the right colors. But then on my father's side of the family, I'm one of the fairer ones, so then I get a lot of, oh, you don't want to date a certain type of person because they're too dark for you. I never took it as an insidious comment or a hurtful comment. It was just to the people who said it, something that was ingrained in their mindset. But does it worm your way into your subconscious thinking and then consequently into your outward activity and decision-making? Definitely. And I've made an effort in the last few years, amongst other isms that I've been faced with, to be mindful of the decisions that I'm making and the thoughts and feelings that feed into those decisions.
Tokenism is spoken among many fashionistas. I asked Nicole and Danica, is there enough diversity in high-end fashion?
In terms of high-end brands, no. I mean, there's still a bit of tokenism happening. And by that, I mean there's the one obviously Asian, there's the one obviously person of color, but the majority are still waify, tall, white women. I think I do see more diversity overall. The unfortunate part of that diversity, particularly with women of color, it's a caricature diversity. So you see extreme hip to waist ratios, extreme lip to face width ratios. Characteristics of certain women of color for sure that have been noted over time, but not of all women of color. It's not necessarily authentic diversity.
Hopefully it changes because tokenism is still such a huge part of the fashion industry. I think they just need to hire realistic people. They should just break down that wall of this is the type of girl that we want. This is the only type of girl that we want. If you have more diversity, you're not just targeting one type of person anymore. You're targeting more people just because they see themselves being represented.
Once the realization is made amongst businesses that people of color do have substantial and significant purchasing dollars, that they are influential in the space, I mean, Black women are the number one influencers on Instagram in terms of style choices. But there's still the stereotype that, you know, people of color don't have the purchasing power that people who are typically of European descent do.
Shadism is wrong. We need to recognize that it's time for a change to stamp out the stigma and the shade of it all. In Toronto, I'm Aaliyah Harris. So yeah, opening up the conversation about shadism, what do we think? Do we think it happens in Toronto or?
I personally am so glad that there are more people kind of talking about it, just because that personally I have never experienced that kind of thing. Like, even looking when she was talking about how she couldn't find like the right nude garments to like match her skin tone, like I can only, like, speaking from personal experiences, I'm in like a particular skin tone category where I have never had that problem. Like, I can go into any store, any makeup line, any single thing that has to do with like that kind of color thing, and there has always been my shade. And I grew up and walked through, you know, life being like, you know, I think this is just a regular thing. I've never actually personally had to think about, like, hey, like, there's color.
So, like, but even though you didn't experience it, do you feel like you still see it? Absolutely.
Like, I can see it from other people, and I can, like, notice it when it comes to, like, magazines and TV, and, like, seeing how people prefer and, like, publish and market a particular image. But I can never say that I have personally felt what that means.
Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
The funny thing is, the four of us here in this room are ethnic minorities, people of color, how would you call it? I think we've all experienced that subconsciously, but I think having this discussion being brought out into the forefront in a vocabulary that we can understand, in language that's universally accessible to all, and yeah, it's like that effect. Once you learn about something, you see it everywhere. The same thing. Once I'm informed about shadism, then I can see instances of that in places that I don't really expect.
I see it myself as well. And the thing is, like, as Aiden was saying, like, I'm Black. So, like, even just going into the store and trying to find, like, a foundation color that would kind of, like, match my skin tone. I've personally never ran into an issue where I had to, like, mix different colors to, like, blend in or something. But it was actually mostly my sister, because she's kind of darker than me. So then, like, even trying to find, like, a foundation color that would match her would be an issue. And I think beauty, like, the cosmetic world industry is kind of doing their works into it, trying to make things better. But it's still not really enough, just because not everybody's, you know, meeting up to those, to the colors that they try to make for everyone. So, of course, it goes beyond just foundation color. It also shows up into, like, the industry and what we see on television, magazines, and stuff like that. So it definitely goes beyond that.
I think this is a perfect transition to our next story. Tiffany, your story focuses on ethnic clothing, and you're focusing on African entrepreneurship in a clothing company in Toronto. So why don't you take it away on story number three?
Awesome. So I am African. I originate from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And for anyone who truly knows me, know I live, I breathe, and I love the Congo. And although I've never been there, at least not yet, there are so many things about that country that makes me so proud to be who I am. And the Congo molded me into the patriotic African woman I am, truly. And I feel like a lot of it lies within the culture, because our culture is super duper rich. And when I was younger, I kind of had a hard time accepting it, just because I thought Western culture was better and I wasn't, like, too exposed to it as I am right now. But then as you grow up and your knowledge expands, and you start seeing things in different lenses. So with that being said, to celebrate my appreciation for African culture, I took the initiative to interview Benny Boo, who's of Ghanaian origin. And the goal was to represent success of Africans in the community, and as well as acknowledging the hardships we face to reach to where we go. The loud and annoying construction work on Eglinton West does not stop Benny Boo from keeping African divas, men, and children in style. Originally from Ghana, Benny has brought the vibrant and versatile African fashion into the Canadian scene, and it's received positive remarks. Benny launched her first clothing line of Afrocentric modern exotic wares in 2012. This idea came behind the fact that she noticed the absence of ready-made clothes here in Canada. She took it upon herself to incorporate this trend in Canadian fashion. She remembers beginning her business with the need to emphasize unity through her creativity.
Becoming a CEO was a simple choice for me, because I like sewing, I like designing clothes. It has been my passion for a while, so why not do something I'm passionate about and still get rewarded for it? It feels good. That's one of the perks of being an entrepreneur, because then you have no limitation put on you. So if you're working for yourself, you can see the reward, and you are able to create for different people, design for a wider selection of people that will enjoy your talent or your art or your creativity. So it's been good. Back home, we make our own clothes, so you have the flexibility to design your own wearable clothes. So you choose what you like, what you don't like, whereby instead of being limited here, you're limited to whatever you can find in the store. So if you don't like it, that's all that is available. You have no other choice. I've had the option going to tailors back home to design my own clothes, and they make it for me and stuff like that. So that's where it all came from. I enjoyed that process.
It is based on her phenomenal out-of-the-box creativity and designs that help her successfully create clothing for all shapes, sizes, ages, and sexes. She draws her inspiration from her daily surroundings and interactions with different people.
I mostly create stuff that are versatile because I think about myself in my spare time, what I would like to wear, and I like clothing that are versatile. So I can have a t-shirt that can turn into a dress, I can have a dress that can turn into like a long sleeve dress that I can change into a halter dress. With my design is mostly Afrocentric, and North York is predominantly, like on Eglinton, is predominantly Black. So then when you're starting up a business, you have to look out for the demographics. So I did my research, I found out this would be a good place for my business. So even though I live in North York and I work in North York, I travel, I go around the GTA for business or just for pleasure. And I sometimes have the chance to travel outside of Toronto and outside of Canada. So I get inspired a lot when I travel and I see different people, different environment, different things, and just everybody with their styles and their streetwear.
At a young age, Benny's always admired African fashion and the art of seamstressing. Determination and hard work are factors that have led her far enough to have a passion and love for what she is currently doing.
I love sewing. Like, most people will say I'm a seamstress or call me a fashion designer, but I like to be called a seamstress because I love sewing. Like, someone asked me a question the other day, we were just talking, and like, if you win $5 million, would you still be doing what you're doing now? And I said, yeah, I'll probably not have the same shop, but sewing has been a hobby of mine since I was little. So it's just a hobby turned into a business now. So regardless of what, I'll still be sewing something just for the fun of it. So I love sewing.
However, she says managing a business could get tough, as well as dealing with some customers that don't appreciate her innovations.
My job comes with a lot of customer service too. I don't like the fact that I'm emotional about my designs. I get very emotional about my designs. So if I'm creating something for someone and they don't seem to like it, it gives me a lot of hard time. I don't know. I feel emotional about it because I'm into making clothes for people that loves it. So I have to see that love. I have to see that you like it and you appreciate it. If not, then I'm struggling to make it to be perfect. And that's been a problem of my perfection. Is not always good. It's never good. I could have 10 people be happy, and that one person that is not happy is what is going to ruin my day.
Benny has also had the occasion to design clothing for celebrities and does not regret her experience. She has been highly recognized for her work, her numerous successes such as winning Best Designer for the African Entertainment Awards in 2013, as well as being the official designer for Planet Africa TV and magazine awards and gala. Also, she continues to create diverse outfits for the Honorable Jean Augustin, Tracy Melchior, Carolyn Purcell, and founder of Illuminescence e-magazine, May Marie Douai Soa.
I used to design a lot for African celebrities that come from overseas to perform here. Mm-hmm. So when I started, it was a good exposure and I had a lot of fun with that. So then I get to go to different events, meet different people. So that was good. And in Canada or Toronto, I've had quite a few, if you call them celebrities, mm-hmm. wear my designs. So that's been good. It's been good for the business and it's been good for my confidence in terms of fashion. It's a very competitive industry. So if you have celebrities loving your work or loving your art, it's definitely a bonus.
Benny will continue to represent her heritage through the fashion industry as it continues to flourish. Wishing you all the best, boss lady.
With our new collection, it's going to be a wide variety. So we're trying to diversify. So it's not just limited to... Well, I do have other races and cultures wearing my design now, but I want it on a broader scale. So we're going to be diversifying. So that's the future of it.
So yeah, this was really fun to do. I got to know more about, because she's personally my seamstress. She designs clothes for me as well. And it's just a nice feeling seeing that, you know, an African woman is kind of just taking that initiative to create business and to attract people in her community and so forth. So how do you guys feel about success in the community, in marginalized communities especially?
I love it. I don't know about you guys, but I follow so much of like Asian Twitter and Black Twitter and everything, like all those sort of things on Instagram. And I love it when people start to rally behind like certain groups and start to support like local kiosks, local stores, local seamstresses, and all of those people within those communities to really bring that like rich culture to our everyday lives. And just being a person of color, I love seeing that. And I hope that it kind of becomes like on a, I hope it just kind of becomes like a bigger scale, because like I've noticed so many, like as of recently, a lot of the designer stores like Gucci and H&M like have been having so
Gucci
much like,
H&M.
Right? The controversial stuff.
Oh my gosh.
And I just can't, I'm just so excited when people kind of rally behind these communities, because I feel like it's going to become such a great thing.
So personally, my girlfriend's from Nigeria, and she tells me, she tells me like she has like, unless somebody's bringing over clothes from Nigeria, that she has barely no traditional clothing. It's very hard to find. It's only like there's a few retailers out there, and like in Montreal, there's more, but in Toronto, there's a
finding them. Like, it's extremely hard.
Yeah, so she tells me she has stuff, like, flown in all the time or whatever auntie or uncle is coming over.
See, you think that would kind of wake up people in the fashion industry and let them know, like, there's obviously a market for these kind of things. And you'd think that would kind of spur something on, but definitely, I agree with all of you. Like, diversity is just so essential, like, feeling that need for minorities. It's just so important for the culture, and to just provide this kind of area of fashion that suits everyone, is available for everyone.
Just to add on to what Shakira was saying, like, my mom literally has like so much African fabric like at home, and she just has a really hard time finding the right seamstress to kind of like tailor the right clothing for her. So she always, like, whenever someone's going back home, like, she'll give a piece of fabric and be like, and take the measurements and stuff, and then the person back home would do it, but then when her friend comes back with the fabric, it probably like it doesn't sometimes fit her or doesn't meet up to her expectations. So yeah, like, I feel like just expanding this kind of industry, like, around the community and around people for it to be accessible for them is so important. And just to create that sense and environment of diversity is also really needed around here.
Yeah. And I think coming off of the point about like people sending stuff back home, like, I have to do that so often. Like, in the Vietnamese communities, we have like these garments called áo dài's, and they're mostly done out of like silk fabrics, and so much of the time we're sending it back to Vietnam trying to get our measurements, and most of the time we are not talking to the seamstresses. Like, we have to basically tell someone like what we're looking for and hope that they can convey it to that person who is making our clothes. And there's been so many times where I've gotten fabrics brought over and I was like, this is not what I signed up for, boo.
Exactly.
You only wear those clothings on like special occasions or some things within your own ethnic community. It's very rarely that I see people wearing ethnic clothing for just day-to-day casual wear.
I try my
best. But it's like, yeah, but is that because they can't find that clothing. It's maybe not a choice. Like, maybe they would wear it more if there are more options for those people. So all these kind of ideas.
Okay, so with the first three stories, we took a look at themes of identity and what we do to forge an identity, either from changing yourself, changing the industry that you work in, or changing the clothes that you wear. But the questions of identity and belonging take a different tone when you add violence to the mix. When you remove the sense of security that a stable society presents, we get stories that look at these same themes, albeit with a much harder edge. Image, identity, and politics are all intertwined in the Kashmir Valley, and in my story about photography in the Kashmir Valley. It offers a unique look into the human condition and ultimately the quest for belonging, helping me get through this this question. Through a lens of photography is Dr. Arne Kislinko and Nathaniel Brunt. In February 2019, following a suicide attack in Pulwama, Kashmir, an Indian fighter jet was shot down over Pakistani-occupied Kashmiri airspace, sparking a rise in tensions and protests around the world. Joining me is Professor Arne Kislinko of Ryerson University, who specializes in diplomatic history and international relations.
The heart of the Kashmiri conflict are two super important nations, India and Pakistan, which have had a pronounced regional political rivalry that involves many other things, not just Kashmir. It is super complicated from a local, regional, and international level. It's kind of a litmus test of how complicated international affairs can be and how small countries, you know, seemingly remote from the mainstream, can have really consequential effects.
Nathaniel Brunt is a PhD candidate at Ryerson University who specializes in documenting the Kashmir Valley through his photo series #Shaheed.
I started working in Kashmir in the spring of 2013. My introduction to Kashmir was after, I think it was something like 23 days of curfew in the valley, so people hadn't been allowed out of their houses because of the political situation. And so I was working there as a photographer, and then over time my work has evolved to being more academic and more archival based.
You're best known for your work #Shaheed. Can you tell me about why you chose that name for your project? This has a specific meaning.
The name came out of actually a search term that I was using on the internet. Shaheed is obviously in Arabic, or it's used in Urdu as well, is martyr. And in 2013 and 2014, a new phase of the insurgency in Kashmir had started, and many young men from the valley were joining organizations like Lashkar-e-Taiba or Hizbul Mujahideen, and were fighting, and almost always being killed or martyred. And I was following these young men on the ground as they were fighting, but also through the photographs and videos that they were posting online on their social media accounts, which I was collecting and archiving. So the name #Shaheed really came out of this search term that was often being used as a metadata tag on the photographs and video that these young men were posting.
I have with me some photos of #Shaheed. Describe the photo for our listeners and walk through some of the context behind it.
Yeah, this was a funeral that I was at in 2015 or 2016. I can't remember the exact year. I'd have to check. This is Talib Shah, who was from a small village in South Kashmir. He had been killed the evening before. He was part of a small group of Lashkar-e-Taiba militants. There were three of them, and they'd been trapped inside a building. And you can see in the foreground all the people photographing it. So this was really one of those images during when I was doing the Shaheed project. I was looking at both the photographs that I was tracking, which were posted on social media, that these people in the foreground were taking, but simultaneously also looking at it from my vantage point. I mean, what I was looking at is the way that, I mean, conflict has changed in the 21st century, where now everybody has a camera.
So can you explain how that changes the context of the conflict itself?
A lot of the material that documented the conflict in the 90s was was erased. I mean, a lot of it's been destroyed, a lot of it's been lost. So, I mean, that was a period where most Kashmiris wouldn't have had a camera that they were carrying around, and they were still, it was still a time when film was being used. So, I mean, I think one of the things that is very interesting, and I think you got to look at it in a broader context, of the way that war in general, or in insurgency, or what, or any sort of armed conflict is being documented in the 21st century. I mean, now everybody has a phone, and this isn't just the war in Kashmir has been documented, but it's really a global trend. I mean, we look at wars like Syria that are in many ways being documented solely by non-professionals or amateurs.
So how does this change the narrative?
It's hard to judge in the West. I mean, for Kashmiris, I think there's a new generation. You have to also look at it generationally. There's now a whole generation of people in Kashmir who have grown up with the war being their childhood. I think they're really interested in the idea of being able to document what they see as history unfolding in front of them. And these scenes very much of these funerals for young men and women, these were historical moments that everybody wanted to have their own photograph on their phone.
So that's why photographs are so important. They're evocative. They can tell the story sometimes to themselves. You know, we need to point out, as I do to Nathaniel and others, that by themselves, they're just photographs. They can be misused, they can be inappropriate, so they're not exactly, you know, substitutes for other scholarly lines of inquiry, right? But they do serve an evocative and emotional point, which is to connect you in a sort of immediate fashion to real people that are, you know, subject to whatever forces it is that you're looking at. In the case of Kashmir, what I think is particularly important is that Nathaniel's work is positioned to answer what ultimately is the major question in Kashmir, which is, you know, is Kashmir its own place? Is it its own people? Is it right to view them as kind of partitioned, you know, provinces of one or two states, or are they independent entities, right? Are they independent people with a distinct ethnicity and language and so on?
Well, I hate to bring you guys down with quite a heavy topic there.
It's important, though.
But
yeah,
I think the main connection that all of us have is this main question of identity. And with Kashmir, you have, in this situation, an identity that's in flux, or an identity that's not really defined. When you look at all your stories, whether it's on personal identity or trying to fit in into Western identity, or how do you bring your African identity into the West, you have very established and defined parameters. When you look at Kashmir, and when you look at what Nathaniel's doing in trying to document Kashmir, in a sense, he's trying to forge his identity. And I just want to pose this question to you guys. If your identity was under question, how would you respond? How would you react to it? And would you be able to, like, be proud of who you are if you don't have something that's concretely defined?
I think the most important thing is when, in his story, he was talking about how a lot of the people didn't have, like, the phones back then. And that immediately kind of, like, popped the idea into my mind of, like, how now we all have the ability to share our side of the story. Like, when protests go on, or when, like, wars go on in other places of the country, I feel like when Western media kind of captures it, it kind of antagonizes, like, the group of color, like, the people of color within that country. But I feel like when people have access to phones and are able to tell their own stories, we kind of get a bigger and more well-rounded kind of look at what's going on. So I feel like when it comes to identity and how I would personally react, it would be like how a lot of people are reacting now, is to making sure that it isn't just one narrative going out there. It isn't just one story. It's kind of like, hey, like, I'm going to show you what my day is actually really like here.
I think that's the big takeaway with sharing all these stories, is because you have these perspectives and you have these different outlooks that aren't real, that aren't shared. And even when I'm looking at your stories, I did not know anything about colorism. I did not know anything about shadism, or I did not really know about struggles of, you know, African entrepreneurs.
Exactly. Like, when it comes to identity, you can never really understand an issue or something that's linked to it unless it's coming from that person. When it's coming from someone else, it's just not the same. It doesn't impact people in the same way. It doesn't necessarily show the story how, in its most most truthful light. So it is really important. And I just think that when you're looking at issues like this, the conversation is the most important part, talking to people. If you don't talk about it, then people just assume or they just ignore the problem. So it's really important.
Yeah, just to build on what Aaliyah was saying, it is important for people to, like, for us to have conversations about this so that, I mean, even if society isn't, like, the perfect place to be, at least having these kind of conversations would try to at least walk into the lines of perfection, kind of. Maybe not, I don't know. But it is definitely important just so that, you know, we end up avoiding assumption, we end up avoiding trying to not understanding what other people go through, just so that, like, you know, it makes it, just so that society kind of just ends up being a place for everyone to belong and stuff like that. So yeah, having conversations about this is definitely something really important.
Well, I'm really glad that we were able to have this conversation today, taking four stories that didn't really seem connected from the outset and building them together with this common theme of identity and unity and figuring out where we belong. So thank you for tuning in to The Way We Look. We hope that we've opened up the conversation into some of the issues that we've spoken of today. If you'd like to share your story or have any thoughts, let us know at the hashtag on Twitter, The Way We Look. I'm Shakir Rimzi.
I'm Aiden Lee.
I'm Tiffany Mongu.
And I'm Aaliyah Harris.
And thank you for being here.
Reality isn't going to be the same anymore.